So we're going to talk about basically, you know, developmental stages and specifically spiral dynamics. And this is just a subject that I love. It is just a bit of inspirational, transformational knowledge that if you get it, you will never, I mean, you really get it. You really, you know, get it down in, you know, download it into your, you know, your mega operating system. You'll never see reality the same way. And you will, you know, listen to, you know, just the current conversations going on about, you know, politics and reality and war and peace and the world and everything. And you go like, how can they deal with any of these issues without understanding this stuff? And the answer is not very well. So it's extremely enlightening, extremely interesting, and adds a whole dimensionality to the whole field of recovery and personal development that just makes tons of sense and really helps one understand you know, the kind of the directionality of the evolutionary process and how these things develop. And now, spiral dynamics was a system that was developed by a professor named Clara Graves back in the 70s and 80s, maybe even started on it in the 60s. And he did tons of research and took a bunch of notes and blah, 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 but he never really published anything. And he died, and then it was taken over, his work was taken over by Don Beck and Cohen. They wrote a book called Spiral Dynamics, and based on his work, and really great book. You got to have it in your library. Read it. Very interesting stuff. And Don Beck was a tenured professor at North Texas State or something at the University of Texas, and then he left that to go to work with Nelson Mandela and de Klerk, I think it was, who were, when they were transitioning, you know, South Africa from kind of this racist, you know, regime to a democracy. And, this was very, very useful in this process because you found out it wasn't about races, but it was about levels of development. So whether you had an Afrikaners or an African tribesman who were, you know, it wasn't about the color of their skin. It was about the level they're at. So if you had a blue Afrikaner and a blue tribesman, they're going to be, have the same set of values. They're just, pointing them against each other. So anyway, it was very useful in that process. So it has quite a dramatic history of real world, application. And one of the things I love about, spiral dynamics, and it's not perfect, but it is really, really useful. And just like the whole aqua map in general, the more that we look at it, the more that we work with it, or integral recovery or any field, the more you learn. It just keeps opening up and you begin to understand the nuances and the dynamics and it becomes very, just more understandable over time and a deeper body of knowledge. So, but not only does it trace, our ethical or moral development as a species, going back to, you know, as far back as we can look into human history and our ancestors, but it also traces the development of us as individuals, where we start out. And everybody's born at square one. So the moral levels that we are born at would be the same as, you know, our very early ancestors were before even tribal, you know, when they were just small survival bands and stuff. And just as you can see in the embryo, kind of the evolutionary development of the human being inside from, you know, unicell through kind of a reptilian, blah, 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 to, you know, into the human form, you can really trace kind of the inner and the cultural and the ethical belief systems and structures and worldviews of the individual and our species. So,
hey John, may I chime in for a question?
Sure.
How is it possible that both the collective development of a species, let me turn off my phone, sorry, the collective development of a species is the exact same, I guess, like as a species, it would take hundreds of thousands of years, but as a human being, it takes a lifetime? who figured that out? I mean, it seems like, oh, the very same way that you develop through childhood into adulthood and these stages that you go through is the same way that the human species has developed since its, I guess, you know, inception up to now.
Like, yeah.
I mean, who that to me just sounds like bizarre. Like, who how did that come about? Who figured that out? Is that
there it's largely been the work of developmental psychologists, archaeologists, and historians. And that's kind of how, you know, you do it. And of course, since writing came into being, you know, back in Babylon and in the early scripts that came out, you know, it's much easier. And as literature began to develop, it's really easy to look at, you know, the literature of ancient cultures and, you know, not so ancient cultures and older cultures in our own country and Europe, et cetera. By studying, you can say, well, it's very easy to see what the values are there. You know, what are they saying?
Okay.
Divine right of kings? Oh, yeah. Oh, democracy? Not even thought of yet. You know, so you can begin to trace that back. And why the human being seems to replicate this whole history of our species, you know, from the get-go, I don't know. There's just some kind of strange symmetry there. And it's we kind of tap into genetically, and probably there's other fields, more subtle energetic fields of achievement that have been done. So, at this point, somebody is born on the planet and has access, you know, to, you know, education and the ability to read and the internet and stuff like that. It's not too hard to get them to a modernist level where they believe in democracy and stuff like that, because that work has been done for quite a while now, and it's pretty established, and it's easy to kind of tap into that, both the body of learning and literature, but also just kind of that developmental level. So does that help at all?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So, and there's a great book. One of my favorite Ken Wilber books is Integral Psychology, and it's just a great book. He just lays so much out. But in the index of the book, he has about 100 and I think about 130, 150 different developmental models that are all kind of lined up, you know, next to each other, starting from, you know, pre-modern and into modern and post-modern. And you can see basically he did that to show you that people that have been looking at these things through history have basically been kind of seeing the same basic patterns, that things move from more simple and more basic to more complex as one develops. And so you can just see this over and over and over in the, you know, in the study of religion. What was the name of the book? The author wrote about, writing about Christianity, Stages of Faith, and his name will come to me. And it's really beautiful. You know, you can see that at a very basic, you know, what the first kind of religious impulse is and how that, you know, goes through kind of a fundamentalist, there's only one truth, blah, 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 to, you know, very, very concrete, very literalist interpretations. This guy who is the leader of ISIS, this group that seemed to pop out of nowhere and is invading Kurdistan and Iraq right now, I heard on NPR, he made a speech and he said, anything progressive is a sin. Any advancement in anything is a sin. And so he's trying to take this, you know, Iraq or how much territory he can grab and turn it into his projected idealized version of a 7th century Islamic caliphate, okay? And, you know, that's and you know, it's Sunni, but the Sunnis in Iraq, you know, live even, you know, with Saddam Hussein and everything, there was a lot of modernism there. They were scientific, they went to school, they said, you know, we love to, you know, we like to drink, we like to smoke, we like to dance. And we didn't, you know, the 7th century thing is really not that appealing, you know. And so anyway, it's just this crazy clash of means that you see going on. And one of the things about kind of the fundamentalist outlook, whether it's Buddhist or Islamic or Christian or Jewish or whatever version thereof, is that they look back to the golden age. You know, they look back to the time of the prophet, you know, in this case of ISIS. They look back into that period right after his death as being, that was the time when we really figured out how to get it together and what to do. And of course, it's their interpretation. They wouldn't believe, you know, they say they're doing it the true way. So they look back. And of course, when you get, when you move beyond, pre-modern or the kind of the fundamentalist blue we talk about, I haven't got to yet. And you move into modernity, modernity looks to the future for the solutions. Whereas these fundamentalist, worldview, you always look back to the golden age, you know, Jesus and the disciples, they really had together the early church in Jerusalem, you know, or, you know, the Muhammad and the people around him, or the Buddha and his early disciples. We need to get back to that old time religion, right? Whereas when modernism, we begin to have more faith in progress. Oh, we'll figure it out. Science and, you know, advancement and blah, blah, blah. So they're just completely diametrically opposed views of reality. And, of course, the fundamentalist feels very, very threatened by modernity. And that's what they're out to destroy, you know, with their, you know, suicide bombings and, you know, car bombs and stuff like that. They want to do that because they see modernity as a threat to the original pure way that was taught by, you know, the inspired, you know, person, prophet, scripture, Messiah, whoever it was. So that's a footnote. So let's get back to the original subject. So the spiral dynamics, and Don Beck actually color coded them. Claire Graves didn't. He had numbers or something like that. But Don Beck gave them colors so that it wouldn't be like, you know, racist or something, and just so the colors would be easily identifiable. And then Ken Wilber went in and changed some of the colors and got a little more confusing, has his own version, very, very similar. But so I just kind of stick with the spiral dynamic structure most of the way up through first tier, and I'll describe how I deal with second tier. But the only difference, I think, in the first tier colors is, instead of blue, which is like the mythic fundamentalist, you know, old-time religion level, Ken calls it amber for some reason, and Don Beck and company called it blue. But anyway, so what starts out in the beginning is beige. That's the first color in the spiral dynamic system, and that is like childhood development from 1 to 3. It's, or maybe 1 to 1.5, actually, or 2. And it's very early, very primitive, very survival-oriented. It would be at a level of organization when our ancestors were just in small bands. You know, they hung together and they hunted together, and that was about it. And it's just very, very primitive. And, you know, you look at an infant, you know, and the baby's crying, you go, oh, what a selfish baby, you know, huh? I mean, you know, at that level of development of a human infant, those type of descriptors or qualifications don't even apply. You're not a selfish baby. You develop any kind of ego that would support an idea of that. Okay. So that's beige. And that probably, goes back, you know, 100,000, 150,000 years ago up to maybe 50,000. Well, they keep pushing that back, so maybe 75,000 years ago. And, you know, so we, you know, don't know a lot about that level because, you know, the archaeological evidence and anthropological evidence, you know, I mean, you have skeletons and stuff like that, and you have a few artifacts, tool making and stuff like that, but there's not a heck of a lot there. But, you know, you can study, you know, other humanoid or primates, and kind of get an idea probably what that's like and extrapolate pretty clearly, I think. So where it begins to become more human in something that's recognizable as the way humans organize still certain groups on the planet is purple, and that is the magical, shamanistic, tribal level of development, okay? And at that level, you know, their spirits are everywhere. And, you know, they have to be, you know, talked to, understood, sacrificed to, propitiated. You have shamans, you have, blood clans, you have tribal units and more self-organization at that point. And it's a pretty much a very kind of collective tribal, level of awareness. And of course, you know, interestingly enough, in the last, you know, 20, 30 years in the men's movement and the kind of new age movement and kind of the rollicking, you know, spirituality that's been explored, there's been a lot of going back to that thing. A lot of, you know, white folks embracing Native American rituals and ceremonies to get back to that kind of tribal, that earlier way of looking at things, because there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of connectedness. There's a lot of good stuff there that our ancestors developed that we can really bring forward. And you live in a strictly kind of, you know, modernistic, urban environment, you know, where, you know, strip malls and cement and buildings and stuff like that. There's, I think there's really benefit in going back and learning and experiencing some of the ancestral ways. But anyway, be that as it may, and I certainly did. I had a mentor and a teacher, Wallace Brackout, for a number of years. And while I never, you know, I never Sundance or tried to, you know, make myself into a Lakota, which he was my friend and teacher and supported me and taught me when I was really, really going through some very dark, hard times in my life. And I have great love for him. He passed on a few years back, but also deep respect for the kind of deep democracy of that path. You know, the deep democracy, I mean, the democracy extends not just to human beings, but to all creatures. And there's a sense of, you know, they say Mataquias and all my relations. And they're not just talking about your uncle, your brother, your cousin. They're talking about the grass, the water, the buffalo, the birds, bees, all that stuff. And anyway, there's a lot of strength that I took and I needed at that time. And I still hold on to as part of my inner world and the way I view reality. So after purple arose a red, and aptly colored, I believe, because, and that's probably the purple about 50,000 years ago, and where you start seeing the first really strong artifacts are in these, you know, Lacaux, the cave in France, the different caves they found also, where you have these really, you know, way back in these caves, you know, like a mile back, you'll find these incredible works of art painted on the rocks, and they had to be doing it with torches in the darkness. It must have been incredibly powerful to do that, but you can really see this connection and the beauty of the understanding of the spirit and the corporeal structures of the animal. I missed the word that was coming out there. And there's this famous picture of the shaman who's part is part deer, part human, part this and that, and how that, you know, that shape-shifting shamanistic thing is illustrated. So that's around 50,000 years ago. We have lots of solid evidence for that level of development. Then about 10,000 years ago, red began to develop, and that's where you have the arising of the strong man, the chief, that is able to be ruthless and organize groups larger than tribes and go in, you know, war parties or hordes, move into other people's territory or new territories and wipe people out or make them slaves and take over. And, you know, kind of the Viking level, of development. And, you know, you think you just go out and, you know, oh, there's a monastery. Let's, you know, let's kill and rape everybody and take all their trinkets home. there's no thought of like, well, you know, that's really not nice behavior. You know, maybe these people are like, you know, human beings, and, you know, they have families, and we should think about it. It doesn't enter. It's a very first person, me, you know, level of development. And we see that kind, and it's very warrior-like. And the worst thing is to diss somebody, to dishonor them. And there's revenge and feuds and power, and the powerful people, the ruthless, powerful people that can fight and kill good rise to the top and control things. So you can see it's pretty, can be pretty, you know, barbaric, in the sense that most of us understand that word. And, that gave rise. Oh, and of course, if you look at the spirituality that surrounds it, you know, you have the Greco-Roman gods, the gods of Homer, Iliad, what was the book after Iliad, and then he went home. Anyway, the works of Homer, you see the gods, they're not like these all, you know, knowing, loving, you know, great beings that are like superheroes with bad attitudes, and they're always messing with people, and, you know, they have their own feuds, and they have their favorites among the humans. And so you find that in the Mesoamerican gods, you know, in the Aztec and the Mayan structures and stuff like that. So that's that structure, that red structure. And after that, you know, it's what gives rise to these next levels of development is that the old ones get to be such a bummer, and they're not really answering the current needs of people, that the, you know, stress is the mother of evolution, and begin, things begin to evolve. So after from red, you begin to see a blue coming online, and in historical terms, they call it the axial period, and that's when axial, you know, meaning, you know, things turn, things shifted, and that's where you see the arise of the great spiritual traditions that are still around today, you know. So probably the earliest versions were the, you know, in India and the Vedic poems and prayers and all that stuff. You see that, this idea of Brahman, all encompassing, in everything, God or presence. And of course, Atman is Brahman. Brahman is Atman. The idea that very cool stuff even today, that the deepest part of you is none other than, you know, God, everything. And so anyway, and then you see with kind of as that kind of got funky or cloudy, you see the rise of Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and probably the last part of that was in the 8th century with the rise of Islam. And so the story changed there. You know, it wasn't okay to, you know, do the Viking thing, just go wipe people out, or at least not your people. And that there was a one truth, there was a sacred text, there was a sacred teaching that came from the prophet, that came from the Messiah, that came from the Buddha, from the awakened one. And that if you wanted to, you know, be part of this, you know, chosen group, the church, the family, the believers, the Sangha, however, you had to adopt the, you know, the teachings and the practices. And then you became one of the elect in some way. However, and it's not okay to go rape and pillage and all this stuff, at least if it's not your people. So, of course, the problem with that is there's only one truth, right? So if you're Christian, you know, you are part of the Holy Church of Jesus or the body of Christ or whatever, and therefore you can go whack the, you know, the Muslims or the Jews or anybody else who's not part of the, or the Protestants or the, or not part of your version of it, right? Which is pretty bloody mess, right? And same thing with Islam. You know, they, you know, Muhammad was really respected the Jews, but they didn't buy into him, and so he whacked them, you know, and that's just kind of the way it was. And, that, obviously, we see that in the Middle East right now, this just incapacity of Judaism to get along with Islam, which can't get along with itself, which certainly can't get along with Christians. Anyway, it's just a bloody mess at that level. And so what that gave rise to, probably about with the advent of the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, especially in the West, is orange, which is modernism, beginning of modernism. And they say one of the catalysts of this, and, you know, I'm painting hugely broad strokes here, but was the advent of the successive waves of bubonic plague, the Black Death, that swept Europe and killed millions of people. And depending, you know, which time and who you read, you know, sometimes they say that killed off, you know, half to even up to two-thirds of the population of Europe. It looked like the frickin' end of the world. Everybody was just dying. And at that point, you know, all the prayers and the bones of the saints and blah, 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 wasn't doing anything. So it gave, you know, and of course it was passed by, fleas, right, that were carried by rats who were really run a lot of them running around because they kept killing the cats that would keep the rats in check, because they thought the cats were the consort of witches and the devil and stuff like that. So this kind of superstitious stuff was actually helping this disease spread, as it were. So what came out of that was kind of the Sergeant, you know, Friday, you know, orange scientific way of looking at things, just the facts, ma'am, right? And not you know, not the sacred scripture, not the Bible, not the stories, but looking at the world and conducting experiments and being able to do experiments that you can reproduce and say, yes, every place on Earth where we drop that apple, it goes down and hits the ground. There's something here. And this became the way to understand reality, because the old ways just weren't working when it came to keeping people alive from these, you know, these civilization world ending, at least it looked like the world was ending, for most people at the time, diseases. And so that gave rise to, in blue, the mythic fundamentalist level, we would say, is a very collective level. You know, you subsume your individuality and give it to the Sangha, the church. The individual is not important, but the structure and the hierarchy is. Now, with orange, again, the rational mind and science becomes the way to understand the world. And, of course, it made, you know, huge advances in just looking at, you know, the technology that we have today. That was all, you know, chiefly became a product of the scientific method and Newton and understanding the laws of physics and all these things, and telescopes and looking up. You know, oh my God, we're not the center of the universe. You know, we blew all around the sun, et cetera. It just changed everything. And it gave rise to the respect for the individual. So when you read the American, Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, it's a very, very pure, in a lot of ways, artifacts of this orange development. And of course, it wasn't, at that point, it wasn't extended to women. And it wasn't extended to black people and Indians and not, but anyway, it was a move in that direction, that the individuals mattered, and the individual's liberty and pursuit of happiness became primary, and that the will of the people to choose their own leaders was, you know, was embraced. And so it wasn't, oh, you're, you know, King George III because, you know, Jesus said, you're the king, and that's it, you know, and we have to listen to what you say because you're God's anointed and appointed divine right of kings. That went away with, no, that doesn't work. We don't want to do that anymore. We want to have a voice and individual freedom and individual voice and democracy, and all these things were really significant advances. And you see people beginning to, for example, in England, they actually legislated outlawed slavery. You know, without a civil war, the long, hard process. If you see the movie Amazing Grace, I don't, have you guys seen that?
No.
Wilberforce, story of his life, and he was the guy who just fought for years and years and years and years and years to ban slavery in the British Empire, and he finally pulled it off. It's an incredibly inspiring movie if you get to see it, and. His mentor was basically the old sea captain who had been a slaver, captain of a slave ship, who wrote Amazing Grace. And anyway, great, great novel. So, a movie, man. I've actually read books on his life too. It was a life well lived. Let's put it that way. So, and what you see in the American Civil War, you see a largely agrarian blue South. And by the way, most agrarian areas is still in this country are very blue. And in the more urban environments, you find them a lot more orange and a lot more emergent green. So that's still playing out in culture wars, you know, the blue and the red states here. But in the Civil War, you see the blue agrarian South. And they said, well, you know, in Genesis, it said that Ham.
You know, when his sons of Noah was black, he, you know, did some sexual sin to his father.
Therefore, the black people are cursed to be slaves of the sons of Japheth, who's the white guy, according to that interpretation, forever. And they were going, hey, this is God's will. I'm trying to muck with God's will. Don't tell us what. You know? And
John, it's Victoria, and you sort of went away for a little while. Could you kind of start back with the... I mean, I heard the part about the agrarian blue and the orange urban, but then lost you.
Okay. Yeah, and I said, and if you look at the American Civil War, that that is a great example of the largely urban industrial North conflicting with the blue fundamentalist agrarian South. And I would say, and in the interpretation of the fundamentalist agrarian blue South, they trace back the rights of slavery to Genesis and the story of Noah. He had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And apparently, you know, this was after the ark landed or whatever. Ham, who was the father of the black races, did some kind of sexual sin to his father when he was passed out drunk. This is really in the Bible, believe it or not. And therefore, he was cursed to always serve in the tents of Japheth, who was the father of the white people. Okay. So in the South, they're going, well, the Bible says this is ordained of God, blah, blah, blah. And in the North, they're going, they're not thinking of it in fundamentalist, you know, scriptural, thing. They're going, hey, you know, I can walk a mile. These are human beings. Okay. And one of the things we know about developmental psychology is that the higher you go up, the more, other perspectives you're able to take. Okay. That's one of the prime indicators almost across the board for people who have done this research say this. So they are able to put themselves into the shoes of slaves and going, hey, these are human beings. And that's not okay, you know. And so anyway, you know, and people say it was about states' rights, and especially in the South, they try to debunk it, had slavery had anything to do with it. Yeah, it was about states' rights, but it was about states' rights to have slaves, you know. So anyway, so that was the huge conflict. And of course, at that level, Orange won, you know, and slavery was done away with. And, you know, it took another 100 years to, you know, for things to begin to open up. But anyway, so that's part of that process. And any questions? I've just been talking quite a while.
Nope, not on my end.
Okay. Is this making sense?
Yes.
Excellent. So you know, so then we go with Orange, and Orange, like I said, it started about 300 or 400 years ago and really got rolling with the, you know, with the American Revolution, and that just, you know, it's like dominoes. I mean, most countries on earth right now are democratic, and they have some form of election and parliaments and elected, you know, presidents or prime ministers, and even the totally non-democratic countries like, say, North Korea, they call themselves the People's Republic, you know, Democratic Republic, and there's nothing democratic about it. But anyway, so that has just become, but most countries now have some form of democracy. And that's another of the explosion that Orange, when it really reached a powerful meme. And they say that when any one of these memes, that's what they're called, or stages, comes online at about 10% to 30% in a society, it really starts shifting everything, making big waves, making big differences. And they say that when the American Revolution happened, perhaps only 30% of the colonists were actually at Orange, but they were able to, you know, pull it off kind of miraculously to say that, you know, that, and establish Orange values, and which had to be further developed with the abolition of slavery, and then with women getting the vote, and, you know, I mean, the revolution is ongoing, but it started there.
John, do they know what percentage of the Western world is in postmodern? Are there any numbers on that?
You know, in the United States, it's probably about 30%.
Okay.
And probably in Europe, it's a little higher than that, you know, about 35-40%. They're more green going on there than we are. So, which brings us up to the postmodern, or the next level after Orange, or modernism, which is postmodern green. And I've been talking about a lot of, you know, the positive things that Orange brought into the picture, is, you know, individual rights, democracy, you know, women's rights, and abolition of slavery, a lot of really great things. But of course, it also becomes very success oriented, and capitalism is another another fruit, if you will, or growth or product or artifact of orange. And in a lot of ways, you know, that's kind of cool because, you know, it democratized wealth. In other words, you know, people could, you know, the American dream, you could start from nothing. And if you were lucky, work your way up and be successful. Obviously not everyone, but, it also becomes, in the negative aspect, it becomes very so individualistic, you know, that, and also materialistic that, you know, it only matters he who, you know, dies with the most tinker toys wins. And there's this kind of weird, dark strain in capitalism that, you know, from the Ayn Rand and all of this stuff, that, you know, the rich are the special, smart, blessed people, and the rest of us are just fertilizers so they can manifest their greatness, and we shouldn't muck with them, you know. And it's like, so it doesn't really give you the tools to deal with poverty, right? And all the problems of poverty, of, you know, sanitation and education and housing and dignity and blah, 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 because, hey, the rich people got it, and that's cool. That's just the way it is. It's the free market forces, and that's some kind of magical thing that makes everything work. Well, it really doesn't. The evidence doesn't support that. So that gave rise to the green movement, all right, the postmodern. And in other words, even in civil rights, Orange was only able to take it so far. But then, you know, then it kind of petered out and things just got, you know, structured, with, segregation and, you know, all kinds of awful things going on in the South, where I'm from. And, it took the Green Movement, to really infuse, this, the American Revolution or the liberation of people or blacks and women and gays and Native Americans, anybody, you know, any minority group that had been oppressed, to give them a new voice. And whereas Orange is largely an intellectual construct. I mean, you can analyze things and see different perspectives. You know, you can see, oh, well, there's, you know, religion is a big subject, and there's different ways of viewing God. You know, to you it's Jesus Christ, to them it's Allah, to them it's, you know, whatever. So, but Orange is caused a deep opening of the heart chakra, basically, where people could deeply feel the suffering of others, and that diversity is seen as a strength and a richness and a goodness, whereas it's kind of tolerated at Orange, and at Blue it's seen like the end of the Roman, it's the end of civilization, there's colored people everywhere, oh my God, you know, that sort of thing. If you go, for example, if a blue person goes to San Francisco, they, oh my God, there's homosexuals and black and orientals and Jews and you know, it's terrible. And where a green will go and think, oh my God, what a rich cultural experience. This place rocks, you know, so it's completely different ideas and things. So, green, was, you know, the whole thing starting in the late 50s with the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the countercultural movement. Gay rights, anyway, animal rights, all these things, really brilliant stuff, good stuff. I mean, my brain. But there's some problems with it because it is in many cases a reaction against Orange, which is kind of the dominant center of gravity in the United States at this point still, even though Orange Green is becoming much more prevalent. And, just, you know, look, watch television, go to the movies, the values are in this. Television shows, and blah, blah, movies, advertisements are very orange green. In some cases it throws the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, because science is seen and the intellect is seen as the thing that's destroying the planet, therefore the brain and the intellect is bad. It becomes can become anti-intellectual, and we just need to be, you know, be intuitive and have feelings and emotions and, you know, hang out. And that's a problem because it becomes unbalanced. And anyway, so that takes us up to the Green Revolution. And right now, there's a lot of green in the United States. It's probably about 30% or more at this point. It's becoming very easy, especially younger people are able to move into green quite quickly. You know, and whereas it took us older folks a while to struggle to get there, it's easier for those who come after us to get to levels that we were at a much early age. But there's problems. In other words, the anti-intellectualism, the kind of mushy new age soft thinking, and because you rejected science, so we need to bring that forward. But and that's what happens at this next thing that happens after green, just in the last 10 to 15 years or so, this thing called second tier. And of course, Clara Graves was actually seeing this back in the 70s and 80s, and he said that what he was observing at second tier, he said, this next thing that was coming forth, was emerging, was not just, the next level, and the next rung in the ladder, or the next, twist in the spiral. He said that it was an unimaginable gulf of meaning is crossed over when we move from late first tier green to this thing called second tier. And I think, anyway, the colors, Claire and Ken change the color, so I just call it second tier, early second tier, late second tier, because it just makes it clear in my brain. So what happens there is, well, and one of the characteristics, going back to first tier, is that each one of these levels thinks that it's absolutely right and everybody's absolutely wrong, okay? So if you watch Fox News, and anybody who is not kind of blue-orange is just considered, the Antichrist. I mean, they're liberals. Oh my God, and the liberals just can't stand the Republicans, and we can't even, it's even hard to have any, to govern, the country now because the Congress, the House and the Senate are just so split. You will never have a Republican that'll cross over and vote with a Democrat or vice versa. It's just this complete fissure. So,
John, have you read any of the papers from Institute for Cultural Evolution? Steve McIntosh and these other integral thinkers got together and created a platform that speaks exactly on what you're just talking about now.
I read Steve's book.
No, it's not. It's not in his book. It's on their website.
Could you send me a link to that, please?
I absolutely will.
Awesome.
It's so, very good.
So
send it to both of us if you would, please.
What's can that? You,
I don't have your email.
Oh, John. Oh. We, John.
No, John. I have yours. I.
We'll figure that out. Don't worry about it now.
Okay.
Yeah, we should have a place.
Hey, Hamlet, you could send it to me, Heidi, and I can share it with everybody.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Thanks,
awesome.
Heidi.
Sure.
So anyways, you see this. This absolute, just stuckness and fissures that create, that are created at first tier. And if you're, solidly orange, and when they say you're orange, that generally means that 50% of the time, and this is kind of just a generalization, but when something happens, you will approach it from an orange level of morality. And about 25% of the time, you might do a green thing on it. 25% of the time, you might do a blue thing, the level under it. So, but the center of gravity, mostly you act from there. So there's this huge stuckness, and everybody, the blue think, or the amber, blue and amber think that the green are just a bunch of, pot smoking, pagans, and that the orange are just mammon loving, materialists, all they kind of get along more. But the orange will definitely think that the fundamentalists are just Bible thumping whackheads. And that the green are just a bunch of soft-minded tree huggers. Anyway, and not to mention, red, the gangster culture and all this stuff that we see and Nazi, brotherhood, whatever, all that Aryan brotherhood kind of stuff. That's all kind of blue. But mainly it's a struggle between the blue, orange, and green. And when Bush, for example, was the latest Bush, George W., as president, the green progressives felt completely out of influence. Nobody cared what they thought. Why? Because nobody did care what they thought. The Republicans had both houses of Congress, Supreme Court, the presidency. Screw you guys. And so under Clinton, it was a much more kind of orange green connection, and the fundamentalists felt kind of left out. And with Obama, you know, I think Obama in many ways has tried to send some really integral moves at times, and it's been violently opposed by the right. Anyway, so you can kind of watch these things and see how it happens. But anyway, so what happens at this, at the second tier thing, is that this huge leap of meaning is that all of a sudden you understand that all of these different levels are just part of the inner source code of human experience. And everybody's born at level one, and you can have just great progressive hippie parents, and you're still born at level one, you know? And they can try to instill all your values, blah, 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 and you're still born at level one, and that can cause problems, because if kids, for example, if you're not able to play cowboys and Indians and combat, you know, cops and robbers, and, you know, green parents will say, oh, my God, guns and violence and blah, blah, blah. Well, no, what these kids are doing, they're playing this out in a fantasy level so they can work all that stuff out, because it's an earlier evolutionary level, and it's okay when you're doing it with, you know, sticks and, you know, fake guns, and it's much better to play that all out than when you get to be a teenager and then you react against never having been played the fantasy, and you join a real gang with real guns and really start hurting yourself and others. So anyway, that's just one of the implications of this kind of developmental understanding. So at second tier, you understand that all of these levels are always going to be around as long as we're, you know, humans are there, and that they all have their strengths and they all have their negatives. And Jeff Salzman one time in a lecture said that second tier has kind of a pastoral relationship with first tier. In other words, you try to negate as much as possible the negative aspects of the different things and bring forth their gifts. Okay, so there's a lot of really good stuff in blue. There's a lot of humility. There's a lot of service. It's not greedy about money. It's about higher power. I mean, that's some really cool stuff that we all should have a good, developed, healthy measure of. You know, of course, you don't want there's only one truth and, you know, the fear and the, oh, Jesus is coming back, so let's just trash the planet and he'll set up heaven here in a few years anyway, so who cares, right? That kind of stupid stuff, I would think. Stupid stuff. Anyway, so, and you know, orange, I mean, oh, my God, the inventiveness, the success-oriented, the problem-solving, the incredible thing, and they say that just antibiotics, for example, has increased the life expectancy in the West by 30 years. Just antibiotics, you know? It's incredible. 30 extra years of life. I mean, that's an incredible gift. And there's, I know there's problems with it and putting the beef and everything. But orange, green will only see the nasty aspects of it. They won't realize it's saved so many millions of lives. Anyway, so that becomes part of the work. And you learn that if you're going to communicate effectively to people at whatever level they're at, you need to language and talk in terms that they can hear. So if you're going to be talking environmentalism to a bunch of blues, you can't just bring a bunch of orange and green data and shove it down their throats and think they're going to get it. They're going to resist you. They're going to say you don't. God's going to take care of it. Anyway, there's all kinds of issues there. So you have to talk in terms of faith and stewardship and the creation and respecting the creator and do that kind of languaging and use appropriate verses and similes and metaphors. And they'll hear you and they'll pray and they'll really do a better job. And at orange, you know, you need to talk in terms of success and science and outcomes and marketing and this percentage of the market, you know, thinks we're in an environmental crisis and they will buy, you know, this much of products that are environmentally friendly, and the number is going to look like this in the short term and look like that in the long term. You got them, okay? And green, you just like, you know, they just care. You know, your trees are people too, and they get it, and there you are. And of course, at some of the problems when you're dealing with green, if you talk about spiral dynamics, for example, green, they really resist it, and because you're talking about hierarchies of development, and green is very communitarian. You know, everybody's equal, everybody's valued, everybody's good. So you're saying some people are smarter than other people, some people are at higher levels. You're saying that, you know, that Donald Trump is higher than, you know, Hiawatha. You know, they get really mad at this stuff. And one of the things that I did one time when I first started teaching this, I don't like lines either. Green likes round things. I like circle cycles of life, not linear history, for example. So when I was teaching this in wilderness. I was working wilderness programs in the early days. I was just kind of learning it myself. I did away with lines or levels or spirals, and I said these are ever widening circles of compassion and care. Because at each level, you're able to care about more. And everybody, oh, yeah, okay. They were cool with that. So that was a kind of a skillful means, you know, kind of a second tier way of talking to green. And green's beautiful. I mean, green is, you know, and I was green for many, many years, you know, deep, dark green, at least 20, if not more. And when I moved to second tier, and this is true, this is a dynamic of all these levels of development. You pretty much have to deconstruct the level you're leaving behind in order to justify moving on to a new set of values and understandings. And so in the early days, it was, and it's really easy to do, you know, you can listen to Rush Limbaugh and he will just pick apart and make fun of green all day long, you know, and score some good points. But remember, he's doing it from a level that's a lot lower than green, you know. So anyway, there's that.
John, when you say you had to deconstruct green, what do you mean by that?
Well, I meant that, you know, when you have a green meeting, for example, you usually don't get anything done, but a successful green meeting is when everybody gets a chance to express their feelings, you know, and that's good. And then if you get up in front of people and you speak as an expert, they'll go like, are you trying to say you're smarter than us? It's like we're all equal, you know, kumbaya, baby. Yeah. So you know, there's things like that. And I think it's very good that people get to express their feelings, but also, you know, you have to get stuff done. And what happens, you can really say that second tier is largely primarily a beautiful integration of orange and green. In other words, you have the can-do, inventiveness, skillfulness, intelligence of orange with the big, gorgeous, beautiful open heart of green. And man, that's cool. That's good stuff. You know, and I think one of the pathologies and I'm almost out of time, of at second tier, you'll find that people will try to go from orange to second tier, and you really have to go through green. You have to have your heart open. You need, green makes you worthy of second tier. You know, you have to have that compassion and that empathy that comes on, at the green level of development. And that's all I have time for now. And I think that we should probably do another lecture on this, but we'll start really applying, see how it applies to specifically to integral recovery.
Awesome.
Hey.
Hello?
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 Yeah, I hear you.
Looks like everybody's still here.
Okay. I guess that's a wrap.
Okay. Class. It's awesome hanging out with you guys like this, and I hope that was useful. And we'll see you next time.
John and Heidi, I send that link to you guys, okay?
Thank you. You're welcome. It right on to you, Victoria.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Victoria.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Okay, good, you guys.
Okay,
we'll
thanks,
see you
John.
On Friday.
See you guys Friday.
Hey, bye.
Okay, good. Bye-bye.